Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, ScottHorton.org, 11 to 1 Texas time every day here, ScottHorton.org. And every day but Thursday at NoAgendaStream.com. Find my full interview archives at ScottHorton.org. Sign up for the podcast feed if you want. Sooner or later, we're going to get the whole show podcast feed fixed, but I don't know. Anyway, you can definitely get the interviews all there at ScottHorton.org. And you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. And our first guest today is our good friend Jason Leopold, author of News Junkie and reporter for Al Jazeera.com, and I don't mean the fake Al Jazeera. They finally got that URL away from the fake Al Jazeera. AlJazeera.com, AlJazeera.net, either way here. It's the great Jason Leopold, and his latest is a Guantanamo tour. Much ado about nothing. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Jason?
Hey, Scott. Great to be with you again.
Very good to have you here. Listen, before we get into the Guantanamo stuff, is it okay if I ask you a little bit about Michael Hastings here?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it had been a little while since I interviewed him, honestly, just because I put down the book, The Operators, and I was embarrassed I never finished the book, so I never interviewed him about the book, and then I never interviewed him about anything after that either, because I'm stupid, and now he's dead, and so, oh well. But anyway, I know that you and him were, you know, actual friends, and so I was just hoping you could tell the people about him and what you think and things like that.
Sure. Well, you know, he was... For a guy who was 33 years old, he was just so, I'm not even sure I can, you know, generate the right words. I mean, because, you know, when I heard the news, what was it, a couple days ago, it really hit me hard. He was an incredible reporter who, you know, everyone has been saying, those who knew him, you know, very old school. I just found him to be just so incredibly passionate about not just reporting, but about the truth. We started to speak last year regularly after I had obtained some documents from the Department of Homeland Security in which these internal emails showed just how nuts the Department of Homeland Security went over a report that Michael Hastings wrote for Rolling Stone about the Occupy Wall Street movement. And, you know, these emails were just hilarious because it said the Department of Homeland Security officials were saying, we need to call up Michael Hastings and explain to him our mission. You know, they were talking about pressuring him to, you know, correct his story, take down his story. I mean, they were basically trying to, say that his story was wrong. I was putting together a report. I got on the phone with him, and, you know, we just started talking about first of all, this story, you know, and he laughed and said, he actually tried to call the Department of Homeland Security for comment when he was putting the story together, and they wouldn't comment, we're just talking about the Freedom of Information Act and, some of the stories he was working on and how I was going to, you know, really utilize the Freedom of Information Act to try to get, you know, some of that material. And, you know, he was like, go for it. But he was just, you know, he was just an all-around nice guy in terms of a reporter and just really cared about the stories. Really did not want to be, pigeonholed in terms of being identified as, you know, liberal Democrat, libertarian, whatever it is. He was just a person who, you know, lived and breathed journalism. It really was, something that he was incredibly passionate about. And, you know, somebody who was just 33 years old, to have that kind of experience and to be so authoritative in his work and writing, it was inspiring to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was out here in LA and, you know, starting to, write about, you know, the entertainment industry, as well as continuing to work, on, you know, some political, issues and some of his, you know, stories that he was, working on, you know, certainly involved, you know, the CIA and he wrote this incredible story last year about this, you know, these abuses that took place at this hospital in Afghanistan. And that's actually what I spoke to him about, recently, was this Freedom of Information Act, request that I filed, you know, trying to, grab all these documents from the Department of Defense. So, you know, I'm not sure that really completely answers your question. It's just, for me, you know, just hearing that news is just, wow. It was truly a shock. You know, just really.
Well, look. Let me tell you this. From my point of view, I mean, you know what I do. I don't do journalism like you guys, man. I sit here, but I'm kind of the clearinghouse. I talk to all of you guys.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's really very few. I think some of my listeners probably get bored and quit listening because it's the same guess over and over again. Because I'm pretty picky, and there's not too many journalists and or you know columnists, opinionists out there who, you know, have the attitude to get the job done well. You know what I mean? To get the correct job done. So, you know, like during the Iraq War, I interviewed 100 reporters about the Iraq War, and a lot of them would just, well, yeah, David Petraeus said this, and so I guess I'm supposed to repeat it now or whatever. And with him, it wasn't a matter of he would get it right on the follow-up question. Like, he always got it right in the first place. I didn't have to, like, you know, set the question up. Hey, isn't it true that they haven't proven that any of these EFP bombs are really coming from Iran? He just bring it up anyway himself. He already knew that was the important point.
Right.
That, yeah, they keep saying these bombs come from Iran, but there ain't the slightest bit of evidence yet. I'm pretty sure that was some of the first stuff we talked about back in, you know, 07 and whatever. You know, his piece on Afghanistan, he's not embedded with the Americans. He's out cruising around on the Durand line, hanging out in Pashtunistan, unembedded, just reporting on the real war. You know what I mean? Like, there are very few reporters. You know, I think of Patrick Coburn and David Enders and a few others who are really willing to get out there and risk their skin like that. Scahill, of course. There are very few who are willing to, who have that very independent attitude that you're talking about, but then also the very real willingness to be over there in danger, getting the job done.
Yeah, you know? You have to think about this, Scott. And I will tell you that I thought about it. And I think this is what really, you know, it's what really made me sad is, you know, in my reporting about Guantanamo and Michael's reporting about, you know, whether it's the Afghanistan hospital or whether it was a Hollywood producer, you know, who ended up in jail, which is one of his recent stories. You know, I've asked myself many times, you know, why do I continue doing this reporting? And it's a difficult question to answer because it's not sexy. It's certainly not making me any friends. And, you know, the same goes with Michael. And, you know, he knew that and, you know, he certainly didn't care about that. And it's amazing that, you know, there's a lot of risks that, you know, that we take. As reporters. And, I really cannot answer that question as to why, you know, continue to do this type of work. And I know that for me, I'm just compelled to do it. It's just, you know, I feel like I'm just chasing something that eventually I'll, you know, find, you know, whatever the truth is. And, you know, I think Michael's work, you know, his body of work is incredible, in that it really shows that he too was, you know, chasing, you know, not just the truth, but really wanted to let the public know that, you know, what they're being told is not exactly, certainly, it's not the truth necessarily, and it's not exactly the way it seems. There's, you know, there's a whole different world, and the only way to do that is to really be independent, to be unembedded, to be, you know, to he took his observations, you know, and shared it with everyone. And, you know, I was reading some of these tweets, and, you know, Geraldo Rivera, you know, tweeted yesterday, you know, a tragedy about the death of Michael Hastings. But, you know, let's not forget that he was responsible for taking down or for ruining the career of one of our best generals. And, it, you know, that it angered me. It frustrated me because he committed an act of journalism. You know, it was actually the, you know, General McChrystal himself, you know, who was responsible for his own behavior. You know, Michael was there and reporting and, you know, observed what was happening and shared that. And that is the type of journalism that you don't see. And that kind of response, you know, from a guy like Geraldo Rivera, which, you know, I don't think of him as a journalist, but it really did, you know, what it did for me is that it really sort of kind of showed where we are right now in terms of journalism. And, you know, this, I'll use the, you know, the latest, uproar, with Edward Snowden, the, you know, the contractor who was, you know, working with the NSA as an example. It's striking to me, Scott, how many journalists, well-known journalists, professional journalists, people who, you know, are supposed to be out there, you know, digging up the dirt, pounding the pavement, and you know, revealing the truth, are so, you know, their response to all of this is just, you know, I'm not sure if it's just based in opinion, but it's more or less that they're not doing their jobs. And
well, you know, the thing is, I think Josh Marshall at the Talking Points memo, sort of out of the mouths of babes, kind of a thing. Just he put it perfectly. From the point of view of the bad guys, he said, look, some of us reporters identify with the regime and some of you others are the outcast types.
Excuse me.
And it's like, yeah, that's right. You're a fascist bootlicking toady, barely
that's
a human
right.
at all. Please continue
at least
on your
way. Honest about it. I mean, but it's, I guess that I'm, you know, maybe I'm naive because I didn't expect that. And I didn't expect to see, you know, I know that the world of, you know, scoop journalism, having been in it, having made, you know, some mistakes as a reporter in that world, is incredibly competitive and, you know, we eat our own. But this is, you know, what I've been seeing is just incredibly sad because, you know, no one's really willing to, you know, to step up and say, hey, you know, actually, excuse me, I will say that Mattapuzzo from the Associated Press, you know, he actually said, well, you know, these are questions we should have been asking, you know, years ago. And had we done that, and he included himself, you know, we wouldn't be asking, you know, these questions now. And it's just incredible to see, you know, the type of response that's being put out there publicly by journalists.
Right. Of course, Hastings really was out there in full force on his Twitter feed, backing Snowden, backing Greenwald, and shouting down the detractors and you know,
yeah.
rollicking and having a great old time getting involved in the fight right away, too.
Yeah, I mean, and look, you know, it, you know, you said, you know, you used the word backing Snowden. You know, and I think that's really what, you know, for me, I mean, I'm not backing anyone. You know, I'm interested in asking more questions and finding out, you know, and trying to obtain more information. You know, and what I've seen, you know, and how this relates to, you know, Michael Hastings is that kind of response. You know, it's like I can't forget Laura Logan from CBS when you know, when she was so highly critical of his reporting, with Michael Hastings' reporting, and basically, mm-hmm. you know, said that, you know, McChrystal was this, you know, great American, and Michael Hastings will never be the, you know, the type of American, or I'm paraphrasing here, and I may be messing it up, but the gist is that, you know, he's no McChrystal. And this is a woman who's a reporter. You know, she wears that, you know, that badge. I'm a journalist. She works for, you know, for CBS. And, And that's really where we are. So his loss, you know, aside from the fact that, you know, that I knew him and was getting to know him, you know, very well, knew what he was, you know, what he was working on and you know, sharing some stories, is a loss for everyone. And as you noted, there really are very few people that are out there doing this type of work, taking these types of risks. And, you know, it's difficult. This is a very sort of difficult job to do, particularly right now, Scott, because people are not speaking to journalists. You know, one of the reasons that I was speaking to, you know, to Michael about Freedom of Information Act is because, you know, I have sources, but I'm here in Los Angeles, and it's very difficult to, you know, for sources to feel comfortable, you know, speaking to me about certain government activity. There's really no incentive for them to do it anymore if it could mean that they will, you know, be prosecuted, investigated. So, you know, the alternative methods is using the Freedom of Information Act as flawed as it is to, you know, to try and obtain, you know, information.
Well, that's, you know, and one of the biggest stories of this decade, I think, that has gone so underreported is the chilling of sources for investigative journalists in this country and what that's really come to mean for journalism and all that. But I'm sorry to stop because I need to ask you about the cause of death here, because obviously, as you mentioned, he's working on CIA stories. As a matter of course, Michael Hastings is making powerful enemies because he didn't cover the local zoo beat. He covered the who ought to be in real trouble beat. And so, you know, people are concerned about that. On the other hand, I saw a video this morning that looks to be him blowing through a very solidly red light at Santa Monica and Highland this morning. You have any idea what the hell he was doing out at 4:30 in the morning, or do you have an opinion about, you know, all the suspicions and whatever?
You know, I don't. You know, he was working on stories. I know, look, a lot of people working on stories like that.
You got WikiLeaks. I should mention, I'm sorry, I should mention, Jason, in my setup here that WikiLeaks is saying, oh, he contacted our lawyer just before he died and this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm not sure why WikiLeaks, you know, said that, and I'm not sure. Obviously, they're, you know, trying to make a point in that. They did the same thing with Aaron Swartz, you know, the internet activist who killed himself, you know, saying that, you know, he contacted them or he helped them. You know, the implication is that there was murder, there was foul play. Look, I have absolutely, you know, no idea. All I know is that, you know, he was out 4:30 in the morning. I'm aware of, you know, I've lived in L.A. for a long time. I know Highland and Melrose. It's
I do too.
It's notorious for accidents, you know, and I certainly don't want to, you know, get into that area without really knowing anything other than the fact that, you know, at this point, it just looks like there was, you know, an accident. He was going very fast. I watched the same video you watched, you know, you know, that's pretty much it. I'm not sure. I mean, I am very interested in what WikiLeaks, you know, what their, you know, their point was and all that. I mean, they sort of throw out this tweet and then move away, you know. Well, why?
Well, you know, I mean, I could have tweeted that, you know, he had just been meeting with Jason Leopold about a FOIA request, or, you know, so what?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, he was a journalist. He called lawyers and things sometimes, or what, you know. Maybe he was being investigated by the FBI, but the FBI,
you know, when I heard about, you know, about his death, and, actually heard about it from your wife, Larissa, and I, you know, immediately filed actually a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI and asking for his case file, if anything exists.
There
so,
you
know, just because, first of all, that's what I do, and I'm pretty well known for, you know, for doing that. So I filed that. You know, I look, you know, I did the same thing when Hugo Chavez died, of, you know, ask the FBI for his file as well. So, you know, we'll see if anything comes from that, if there's anything in there. But, you know, at this point, it's for me and many people, including you, I imagine. It's, you know, it's a loss of a great journalist, you know, someone who was just working on incredible stories that, you know, we won't get the chance to read. Hopefully, you know, perhaps somebody will pick up, you know, what he was, working on and run with it. But, you know, it's really a loss for all of us because he was doing some great work and he really believed, in what he was doing. And he was incredibly passionate, and that kind of passion is just really difficult to find right now.
Yeah, certainly true. I want to mention real quick about that, well, something about L.A. always compelled me to drive fast, too, especially on the freeways there. It's the whole damn town is like a racetrack to me. I don't know. I guess apparently he saw it that way, too.
Yeah.
You know, he's a brash young male. It makes sense that he might be driving fast in the middle of the night. You know what I mean? There's nothing suspicious about that. And I wanted to point out that I read one of these sites where someone had a theory. The comment section seemed to be populated with car experts, right? Not people who are interested in politics or journalism at all, but people who are just, you know, insane about cars. And
right,
they were talking
yeah.
about how, yeah, it looks like an accident. Give me a break. And they pretty much all, you know, were unanimous about that. One of them even said if he'd been in a lesser car, it might have broken in half and tossed him free of the fire. But because he was in a Mercedes, it held together. And unfortunately, you know. Worked against him in this particular case, but it's just a random chance. You know what I mean? It's like they found bones from September 11th on top of skyscrapers a mile away. Like, how the hell did that happen? Who knows?
Right.
Numbers, throw a bunch of numbers in a random generator thing and see what happens. A bunch of terrible stuff. Who knows?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, and like I said, I've lived in L.A. for a while. It's a car city, and, you know, there's no time when you can't turn on when you do not turn on the television that you won't see a car chase. You know, I saw it last night. You know, car chase, car crash. I mean, breaking news here, Scott, is you know, we have a car accident and a wreck at on La Cienega. I mean, that literally they'll cut into the news or we'll get some breaking news about that.
Well, in fact, part of the reporting on Hastings was that this was the only crash that happened in L.A. last night, and that was unique.
Yeah.
You know?
That, I will say that actually is pretty unique, you know, because it's, like I said, it's L.A., and, you know, it's there's many, many accidents. You know, I live on a road where every morning, you know, people are just speeding, and oftentimes I'll wake up to, you know, so that is certainly, you know, not unusual for L.A. But, you know, look, I mean, obviously, like I said, you know, the tweet by WikiLeaks was, you know, what's the impression? It's clear. Or what's the implication? That there was foul play, that he was murdered, that this was not just a car accident. You know, for me, I'm not really, you know,
he better really be going somewhere with that, or that's going to really piss me off, you know?
Right. Well, like I said, it was the same thing about, you know, about Aaron Swartz. I mean, Aaron Swartz was doing, you know, incredible work as well. And I think that there are legitimate questions to ask about, you know, what the government was doing. And look, you know, if the government was investigating, you know, Michael Hastings, would that be a surprise given that we already know that the government is investigating or, you know, have been looking at the Fox News reporter, you know, the Associated Press, New York Times? No, it's not a surprise. In fact, I would imagine that anyone doing that type of work these days should know that, hey, you know, you're being watched, or there's a chance that you could be.
Yeah.
Surprised about that.
Yeah, you know, the Fox News lady couldn't believe it when Ron Paul said, "Yeah, I mean, I'm concerned that Barack Obama's just going to kill this Ed Snowden with a drone." Or, you know, just send assassins after him or something. And the lady just thought this was the silliest thing she ever heard. And I only wish that he had said, Don't you remember the news last week was a Fox News reporter was an unindicted co-conspirator in an espionage case for doing reporting out of the State Department, lady? Your colleague.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, you know, I mean, and certainly in that chat with The Guardian, you know, Edward Snowden, you know, said that, you know, the government's not going to be able to, you know, to silence me and or, you know, by he actually used the word murder me. You know, that this is not going to go away by murdering me or silencing me. But, you know, clearly the reaction to that was what's wrong with this guy? You know, he's sort of nuts for even, you know, thinking that way. You know, it's to sort of like bring it back down to, you know, to a place where people can understand. It's very, very dangerous right now to report, on government activity. It really is dangerous, Scott. And when I say dangerous, I don't mean dangerous in the sense that, you know, a drone is going to come in, you know, in to West LA and, you know, take me out. It's just dangerous in the sense that people, you know, that I speak to don't want to speak. There's just, like I said, there's no incentive. Yeah. The administration, this administration, has made it clear that if you reveal any government activity, particularly activity that has to do with national security, counterterrorism, we'll go after you. You know, the whole, you know, the, you know, what the government did with regard to the Associated Press, when we found out that, you know, that they were, you know, grabbed their phone records, ultimately what that, you know, what the whole point of that was is to ensure, Scott, that their sources will never speak to them again, or they'll have a very difficult time cultivating sources. Right. Because now anyone who is a potential source knows that the government will go to great lengths to try to find out who you are.
All right, now hold it right there. Can I keep you over into the next segment here? Because I didn't get a chance to let you talk about your new story at all.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks, Scott.
Okay, good deal. Everybody, this is Jason Leopold, great reporter for Al Jazeera. We'll be right back on Scott Horton Show after this. ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Jason Leopold, now at Al Jazeera, author, news junkie. And we were talking about Michael Hastings, but now we gotta talk about Guantanamo Bay. Oh, but first I gotta mention, since you talked about, well, I'm not scared that they're gonna kill me with a drone, it's just that they've made it dangerous for my sources to talk to me on the phone and that kind of thing. Well, you know, the head of the FBI admitted that he's flying drones around, presumably LA, and I would presume over your house, you know, on a regular basis, just yesterday.
Yeah.
And it's not just the Austin Police Department and some county sheriffs up in, what, Montana or whatever. It's the FBI flying drones for police use against American citizens already. They now concede.
Yeah. Well, look, Scott, let me just say one thing about that. You know, I think years ago this probably would have sounded like crazy conspiracy theory. So, you know, as you know, I write quite a bit on Guantanamo, and you know, recently I've written, you know, many stories about the death of a Guantanamo prisoner named Adnan Latif. Uh-huh. You know, he's a Yemeni. I've made many calls to Yemen, you know, speaking to his family, and I assume that you know, I'm calling Yemen, I'm speaking to his family, I'm talking about Guantanamo, talking about his death, talking about you know, terrorism. I'm sure that you know, that call was monitored, and you know, that's not a surprise to me. You know, it's you know, but I will say that there is, you know, there are very important steps journalists do need to take, certainly to, you know, to ensure you know, that their electronic communications are you know, that they're conversing in ways that are, you know, are protected. So, you know, whether that means, you know, doing it on some sort of, you know, secure network or, you know, if you're communicating via Gmail with, you know, sources, well, that's kind of, you know, ridiculous. You should,
yeah.
you shouldn't be surprised if some trouble happens.
Well, you know, I'm not giving away any sources and methods or anything, but I know that when Larissa was reporting a lot of her, you know, most important national security beat stuff for Raw Story back a few years ago, she might as well have been a spy, the rigmarole she went through with all of her code names.
Right.
And secret methods of getting information here, there, the other place, you know. If you don't want the National Security Agency in on everything that you're doing as a journalist.
Let me just add one more thing to that. You know, and John Kiriakou, the former CIA officer who is now in prison, you know, for what he revealed, you know, to some journalists. I mean, I will say this, that, you know, John, given his background, you know, if you look at the indictment, I believe it's the indictment, but it showed that they basically collected his communications from, you know, they collected his emails. Where was he communicating from in which he revealed this information? His Hotmail account. So, you know, the point being that, it appears that first of all, they got his Hotmail account. I'm not sure if they got it before, you know, if they went directly to, you know, to Microsoft or if they simply just went to his computer and went through all of his emails. But that is just an example of poor operational security. You know, you don't reveal information, whatever it is, you know, to a journalist, you know, through Hotmail. So, or any of those free, you know, email services. And that should certainly be, you know, a lesson, not just for those sources, but, you know, journalists as well. You know, don't reach out to your sources using, you know, using those services, because it's, you know, if you do wind up getting some information, it and it's classified, it could come back and haunt you.
That's good advice for anyone, really. I mean, think about anybody who's running a business that's big enough that their competitor might have some political connections, you know what I mean, or anything like
right.
that. Definitely don't use Hotmail.
Yes. Do not use Hotmail. I think that should be the phrase of the day.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Now, listen, tell us about Latif, because you have done a lot of great reporting on this, and it works. It's part of your story here. Your latest, again, everybody's the great Jason Leopold, a Guantanamo tour. Much ado about nothing. It's at Al Jazeera English, aljazeera.com.
Yeah, and the title, you know, the headline of that story, I mean, the much ado about nothing, I mean, where people had hopefully, you know, taken the time to read it, it's a lengthy story, will understand that it's basically, you know, I had met a nurse there who was, you know, doing some of the force feedings, overseeing the force feedings and conducting them. And no one at Guantanamo, you know, none of the soldiers and certainly the doctors or anyone in the military will give us their names. And when we went to the hospital, there was a nurse there who had a fake name. His name was Leonardo, which he had adopted from the play Much Ado About Nothing, the Shakespeare's play. And in fact, he said at one point, you know, the detainees have a much, you know, much live longer here than they would if they were in their home country. And anyway, he was, you know, trying to say that the whole...
Yeah, but not if they can help it. They're all trying to commit suicide by starvation.
Right, yeah. So, you know, that's the reason for the, you know, for the headline. With regard to Latif, you know, I'm actually working on a, you know, on a follow-up right now. It's been about 9 months since he died. His autopsy report has still not been released. Has not even been released to his family. And as far as I can tell, has not been released to, you know, certain members of Yemeni government officials. So, you know, there are certainly, you know, some questions, that still remain, obviously, about, you know, the circumstances behind his death. There's also an NCIS, Naval Criminal Investigative Service investigation, NCIS investigation into his death. Apparently, that's still ongoing. And finally, there's also a report that that the United States Southern Command did into conducted into his death. It's called a you know, commander's inquiry, and that report is actually finished, Scott. And it was supposed to be released back. It was finished in mid-November. It was supposed to be released in March, maybe February, March. Well, it's now sitting at the Pentagon, behind some red tape. Excuse me, it appears that it's not being released because the information in the report may prove to be embarrassing to, certainly to, to Joint Task Force Guantanamo, to the military, and given the, the public relations disaster surrounding the hunger strike, the timing of it isn't the best. I will say that, the government says that, or the Pentagon said to me that, the reason that the report hasn't been released is, first it needs to be shared with Yemeni government officials, and after that they'll make a decision on releasing it. They dispute that it's that, that it's being held back for any reasons about, trying to, hide embarrassing information. But, his story, Adnan Latif, his death has actually been lost, or forgotten, in the whole story revolving around the hunger strike, which I think is very sad. In fact, I spoke to one of the attorneys who represents one of the prisoners, and I found out that her client, one of these prisoners on hunger strike, actually started his hunger strike after Adnan Latif died. So it turns out that there's several who have been on hunger strike actually since last September, protesting his death. And, they don't believe he died, that he committed suicide. So there are still many, many questions that, that need to be answered, about his death. Certainly, how was he able to, hoard, the medication, the government claims, the military claims that he did, collected enough for a lethal dose. In fact, when I was at Guantanamo, and this is what's going to be in my next report, I can tell you that. So I had the opportunity to interview two guards, and, I brought up the question about Adnan Latif's death, and I said to them, these were guards, one who worked in Camp 5 where he died. And this was a woman, and I said to her, how could a prisoner, or I should say, how could a detainee, because it's made very clear to us, Scott, when we're at Guantanamo, that they're not prisoners, they're detainees. That's not a prison, it's a detention facility.
How about captives?
No. And you'll be corrected. And very, very quickly, no, that's wrong, Scott. These are detainees, belligerents, and truly, that's the kind of response you'll get.
But yeah, right. And as you point out in the story, they're not enemy combatants; they're unprivileged belligerents. That's literally the change made from Bush to Obama. The exact
right.
Same policy, notwithstanding.
Yeah, it's just a different label. The same thing that he did with the war on terror. He retired that phrase, and I guess there's another one that he chose. But I did ask this guard, I said, how is it that if you guys walk the block, okay, you're walking the block every, you're pacing back and forth, you're walking it, you're checking in the cells every 1 to 3 minutes, how is it that a prisoner would be able to hoard enough medication that they would then collect a lethal dose to commit suicide? Not just any prisoner, by the way, but Adnan Latif, who was mentally ill. And the Joint Task Force Guantanamo public affairs official immediately interrupted, saying, hey, we're not going there. We're not going to discuss that. And I said, why? Why not? You know, these are legitimate questions. And just did not want me to get into, any questions surrounding any prisoner, because first of all, they don't discuss any prisoner specifically. They won't discuss any prisoner by name. They won't discuss any prisoner by, their internment numbers. So it's very difficult. Lateef, since he died, there were some questions that they were willing to answer, but, for the most part, off limits. However, this guard said, actually answered the question and answered it in a way that I found very interesting. She said, well, sir, I don't know how they would, be able to collect enough medication to, commit suicide, because we have to watch them, take their medication. And in addition to that, most of the medication, I guess, that she has seen has been administered, and this is what she said, in liquid form. That it's she claimed it was rare in her experience to see any of the corpsmen administering, pills or medication that came in a capsule or a pill, and that in fact it was in liquid form, which obviously raises questions about what kind of medication was Lateef given, what was it in pill form, liquid form. So the point being that there are unsolved or issues that are unresolved here, and questions that still need to be answered. Now, of course, I followed up with what she said, with the military, and they just won't answer that question. When I asked about what the guard said, they just would not go there. So, this was more or less what this tour of Guantanamo was like, and I really tried to, capture that in the story. Started out I think I discussed this with you last time we spoke. Started out the tour by seeing this prisoner staring at me through a cage, through a cell, and giving me a thumbs down sign. Ended it by walking through Camp X-Ray and seeing a rat in one of the cages where a prisoner, banana rat in one of the cages where a prisoner was in. And it was so striking to me, this sort of, these bookends, if you will, starting it with a human being in a cage and a rat in a cage. And it was strange. It was surreal. And, the whole experience about, not being able to, refer to them as prisoners, not being able to, speak about or discuss them by name, the restraints, the shackles, as I referred to them, I was corrected on that. They're humane restraints, and that's not a joke, Scott. That's what they call them.
Well, were they
humane?
They're wrapped in felt, or?
Yes, they're, they're, but the point being that it's not force feeding, it's enteral feeding. It's not torture, it's enhanced interrogation techniques. And you can seriously in that little bit of time, Scott, get so caught up in not just the euphemisms, but how that affects you psychologically, because it removes all images of what would normally be conjured up by mentioning these phrases. When you think of force feeding, what kind of image comes to mind? Perhaps it's someone shoving food down someone's throat. Enteral feeding is very sanitized. Humane restraints. It's you're thinking it perhaps in medical terms. So you're removing any sort of image of brutality.
I think that's such an important point, Jason. That's such an important point, like George Carlin says about, you know, you think in language, and so you can be corrupted if people can manipulate the language that we use. You know, you talk about force feeding and the images it conjures, if you put it that way. A friend in the chat room, I guess last week or the week before, said, well, I think of the hammer and sickle when you say force feeding. That used to be Ronald Reagan's big thing he liked to beat Mikhail Gorbachev over the head about, was force feeding their political prisoners who were trying to starve themselves to death. And what kind of horrible totalitarian monstrosity is that? And, and so you do have to, it's very important that you change the jargon to something that doesn't have an association with something else you already know about, especially something else that maybe your own government has trained you to condemn when it's a splinter in the eye of somebody else.
Yeah, you know, this is, I may have discussed this with you before, but in my stories when I'm writing about Guantanamo, you know, I don't use detainees. I use prisoners. You know, it's pretty clear at this point after 11 years that they're prisoners. And why would I use detainees? Well, you know, that's certainly the word that the government wants me to use. And they, you know, they're very serious about that. But, it, you know, the point being is that, you know, I have the power to, you know, to sort of change it. It's, you know, it's certainly not something, or even use the word captive. Which I know Carol Rosenberg of the Miami Herald, she uses that, you know, quite a bit. But I'm telling you, it was so, you know, after just a couple of days, and you're hearing this over and over again, you know, I had to remind myself, truly, that it, you know, cannot get caught up in using these words, these euphemisms, or letting it sort of, you know, dictate where, you know, where my story goes. And it's, you know, there's this point where I discuss in my, you know, in my story here that, you know, we're taking this ferry ride, you know, to, you know, to one side of the island. And the scene itself was beautiful, Scott. You know, it's Cuba. You're looking at this, you know, these beautiful cliffs and wildlife and water. And, you know, it was a remarkable scene, but I had to stop and say, and remind myself that, this is the I'm traveling right now to a place, to a prison, where the worst, some of the worst human rights abuses, in you know, in the past decade, obviously, have taken place. Where, you know, hundreds of prisoners were brutally tortured. Where men committed suicide. Where, you know, or so we're told. I mean, where, you know, this was. You know, this was a very, very dark place that, you know, that I was traveling to. So it was, you know, and then you enter the prison, and it's really like entering another world, because there are these pillars that spell out honor bound, you know, it's like, whoa, you know, you're seeing these, you know, honor bound, and you're getting caught up in, you know, the value of the week. There's a sign there that said value of the week, integrity. And it's like, it made me dizzy.
It's like kindergarten kind of. Well, it's a government program, right? So it's all government language, especially the military. Everything is newspeak, weirdo jargon in the military. You can't even call it the Delta Force, right? It's the CAG or whatever.
Right.
Everything has its silly little name.
Yeah, and so it was really, I mean, it was an important trip, and, you know, this was a pretty difficult story to write because, and I'm going to be honest with you here, is that, you know, what made it difficult is being so honest, because I knew that what I'm writing is not going to, what I was writing was not going to make, you know, the military happy, was not going to make, you know, the escorts that I had, you know, particularly happy, possibly. When you're with, you know, some of these folks, and this actually goes to sort of like, you know, what we discussed at the beginning of your show with, you know, with Michael Hastings, you know that, you know, your reporting is not, you're not supposed to make anyone happy. And, you know, but being around them during my, you know, time of my trip, you know, I could see, or I got to know them a bit. They were, you know, they were in the military. Guantanamo was not a choice that they made. They didn't sign up and say, hey, I want to go to Guantanamo. But it is a deployment. And they were, you know, perfectly nice people with families. And they were doing, you know, their jobs in terms of, you know, public relations. But, you know, writing the story was difficult because, you know, like I said, walking through Camp X-Ray was like walking through the remnants of a concentration camp. I don't see how anyone can see it any other way, Scott. You know, the way that it's set up, the way that it looks like a concentration camp. And I said that, I wrote that, and I think it's very important to me that anyone who's reading this takes away that image, that understands that that is what this place looks like. That's what, you know, that's what we set up. So, you know, being truly, you know, honest, you know, seeing this, as I said, seeing this, you know, bearded man in a cage and letting people know that what I saw at that moment, you know, wasn't a, you know, a member of Al-Qaeda, possibly. And we know just from the, you know, the fact that it's a low level prisoner, it likely wasn't. But it was just a human being in a cage giving me a thumbs down sign, probably in a way to protest his, you know, the past 11 years that he's been, you know, held without charge or trial.
Yeah, I mean, look at it. Even if he got one shot before the judge and the judge agreed with him on the writ of habeas corpus under the Boumediene decision that, yeah, I don't really see much of a case for holding this guy, he still could just be sitting there the rest of his life anyway. On the indefinite detention. And you know what? We're almost out of time. I got to go to Dan Ellsberg soon. But I wanted to ask you real quick and get your comment on this, whether you think this is important the way I do. But I keep reading about how the actual worst bad guys being held there, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib, and then this guy, I guess it was Bin Attash or one of these guys, that because there's no law, because this is all just made up nonsense, the so-called law governing the court process there, the ones who are actually even getting a pretend trial at all, and not just being held for life on Obama's say-so, that they get to wear camouflage military-style hunting vests so that they can pretend that they're generals in the Al-Qaeda war against America instead of just sitting there in an orange jumpsuit and being treated like the scum of the earth, like some rapist or murderer on his way to Rikers Island or whatever. They get to strut around acting like they're military commanders, the butchers of New York. And I just thought, you know, they can't get a damn thing right down there, can they?
It's true. That was a very big, you know, big controversy is that, look, you know, if they're having a military commission, you know, and this is, you know, sort of like, you know, a trial on a battlefield, if you will, well, then they should have the opportunity to wear, you know, that sort of garb to show that they're, you know, that's who they are.
Which, of course, is their defense, that we're not criminals. This is a war, and we're the generals in the war, and you kill people on your side, and so we kill yours, too, and whatever. Everybody's the same here. Not guilty, Your Honor. That's their argument, but, we hand it to them.
Here's the thing, Scott, is that this, as you know, this is so, this is, no one gets to see this. You get to read about it, but no one gets to see it. So, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, it really is, you know, does it make a difference?
Yeah,
you know,
maybe
I get what you're saying is that, you know, that they can't get anything right, but, you know, that's part of the problem that, you know, about having this, you know, in a corner of, you know, of Guantanamo, where nobody gets to, you know, to witness anything.
Right. Well, that's why they put it in communist Cuba in the first place, so it would be out of reach of anybody except, you know, on their guided tour.
Right, exactly.
And it's supposed to be out of reach of, even the courts and whatever, as Obama said in his recent speech where he pretended again that he meant to close it at all. Did you take that seriously at all, by the way?
I did not take it seriously.
Okay.
And I will tell you that I did, you know, I mean, will you take seriously if I tell you that I want to win the lottery and I'm determined to do it?
Well, yeah, I guess.
Okay. You know,
but it wouldn't mean that much to me, really.
Right, you know, you know, look, he appointed, or his administration is appointing someone at the State Department, you know, to fill the vacancy about shutting Guantanamo. There's a lot, a lot of bureaucracy in, you know, that's involved in this, and it is going to be difficult because of all the politics that are involved. ultimately, though, Scott, you know, Obama does have the power as president to start moving some of these folks out who've already been cleared. He hasn't done that. He still hasn't done that, you know, since his speech. As far as I can tell, you know, there hasn't been any sort of, you know, request, to start releasing anyone. So
I'm sorry, we're out of time.
I just don't think so.
We got to go. Thank you very much for your time on the show, Jason. It's great to talk to you again.
Thanks, Scott. Have a good one.
Everybody, that's the great Jason Leopold. Now writing at AlJazeera.com. The latest is a Guantanamo tour. Much ado about nothing? Not enough ado about a lot. That's what it's really about. And we'll be right back here in just a moment with the American hero, Daniel Ellsberg.
Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
Admit it. Our public debate has been reduced to reading each other's bumper stickers. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. I made up most of them, and most of those when I was mad as hell about something. So if you hate war, empire, central banking, cops, Republicans, Democrats, gun grabbers, and status of all stripes, go to LibertyStickers.com, and there's a good chance you'll find just what you need for the back of your truck. Own a bookstore? Sell guns at the show? Get the wholesaler's deal. Buy any 100 stickers and they drop down in price to $1 apiece. You can spread the contempt and make a little money too. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Every month, Plumline Individualist editor Sheldon Richmond brings you important news and opinions on policy by heroic FFF President Jacob Hornberger, hard-hitting journalist columnist James Bovard, and others from the best of the libertarian movement. The Future of Freedom tackles the most important issues facing our country, from the bankrupt and insane welfare and regulatory states, to foreign wars and empire, the dismal state of our economy, and ongoing assaults on civil liberties. This society needs peace and freedom for prosperity to prevail. Subscribe to the Future of Freedom in print for just $25 a year or online for $15 a year at fff.org/subscribe. And hurry up, because this summer they'll be running my articles about the wars in Libya, Syria, and Somalia in the Future of Freedom too. That's fff.org/subscribe for the Future of Freedom. And tell them Scott sent you.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Over at AIPAC, the leaders of the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C., they're constantly proclaiming unrivaled influence on Capitol Hill, and they should be proud. The NRA and AARP's efforts make them look like puppy dogs in comparison to the campaigns of intimidation regularly run by the neoconservatives and Israel firsters against their political enemies. But the Israel lobby does not remain unopposed. At the Council for the National Interest, they put America first, insisting on an end to the empire's unjustified support for Israel's aggression against its neighbors and those whose land it occupies, and pushing back against the lobby's determined campaign in favor of U.S. attacks against Israel's enemies. CNI also does groundbreaking work on the trouble with evangelical Christian Zionism and neocon-engineered Islamophobia and drumming up support for this costly and counterproductive policy. Please help support the efforts of the Council for the National Interest to create a peaceful, pro-American foreign policy. Just go to councilforthenationalinterest.org and click Donate under About Us at the top of the page. And thanks.